Blog Talk Radio.
Beautiful Metzian folk, this is Sam Maxwell, and you are here on the Metzian Podcast. We are happy to be here at the 60-game mark of the season. 102 games left, if you can do the math, and you know baseball well enough as we do. And here the Mets are at 30-30, pretty straight down the middle. So there's a lot to talk about, and let's bring on our featured guest of the evening. He has produced with Jason Fry a podcast. Well, he's now doing a podcast, and that's National League Town. But he's been doing a blog since 2005, which, Greg, I was just thinking about how it's incredible, you know, for starters, how long the Internet has now been around and that you guys have been doing it for. Your blog can now smoke, as I would say. You've been doing it for 18 years, but Greg Prince, who is, as I like to call, the Mets fan incarnate. Greg, I think this is the first time we're talking in the 2023 season, so nice to have you on board, as always.
Hi, Sam. Good to be with you. Yes, the blog is in its 19th season. It is not smoking. We do not allow that, but we are registered to vote, and we vote for a somewhat more consistent. We vote for a somewhat more consistent season out of the team we cover.
And cover we will that inconsistency. But we also have at the last second somebody who is also a friend of the podcast, who has his own podcast, Baseball and Barbecue. Jeff Cohen, I'm assuming this is you on the other 516 area code.
You assume correctly. How are you guys
well,
doing?
Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much.
So let's. I'm going to go to you first, Greg. Give us your overall impressions. Like you said, it's been a very uneven season out of this 2023 New York Mets squad.
Wow, I don't know where to start with this team because I don't know what to think with this team. You know, you have these small spurts where things are going very well and you figure, okay, now we're doing what we're supposed to be doing, or the Mets are doing what they're supposed to be doing, and, you know, we who root for them are on board with that. We saw a hell of a five-game winning streak, all one-run victories, all of them come from behind, most of them dramatic, and we thought, you know, that was after Tampa Bay and Cleveland. Wow, this team is really ready to cook. And then they go to Chicago and Colorado, and they look sort of clueless. Most of those six games, they come home. They play Philadelphia, primary division rival. They sweep them, don't hit a lot, but they pitch great, and they hit enough. And you say, all right, here we go. And then Toronto comes into town, but by no means easy pickings, but still, you're the Mets. You're three games over 500 now. How about winning a couple of games against prime competition? And they don't hit. They pitch pretty well until the finale, and it doesn't happen. So you're left kind of scratching your head, saying, okay, the pitching looks pretty good, but not as airtight maybe as you need it to be. The bullpen is reliable when it's not overworked, but it's kind of overworked, and it's not flawless no matter how you look at it. And the offense, when it's not a mile above sea level, as it was in Denver, isn't really producing very much, of solo home runs notwithstanding. So this does not feel like the team we signed up for. I don't mean when when we were deciding to become Mets fans as kids. But, you know, when we entered this season feeling like we were, you know, now in that, what was it Steve Cohen said, 3 to 5 years, which I think he was just sort of spitballing when he said 3 to 5 years to win a World Series, but more to the realistic point of being the kind of team that can win a World Series, that is going to be a contender every year. And right now, this is not an elite team. It's an ordinary team with some elite players and some holes in it. So I still don't know what to think besides the fact that 500 some years is great. This isn't one of those years.
Right. Yeah. And I kind of want to delve deep into these types of seasons because, you know, it's hard, at least for Met fans of our ilk, to not think of it in context of other Met seasons and the trajectory and how it looks, you know, compared and contrasting with those seasons. But first, I will go to Jeff Cohen for another broad stroke. This is the first time we're talking in 2023. So go ahead. What is the deal with the 2023 Mets season?
You know, in the words of Mickey Mantle saying to Casey Stengel, I agree with everything Greg just said. It was just it's just an up and down year. There's no consistency. Just when you think the pitching is going well, the hitting goes into a slump. When they're hitting well, the pitching's not doing well. Sometimes you get great starting pitching, and then the bullpen doesn't work out. It's just such a inconsistent team, but I'm confident they are going to get it together. I mean, I know it's only 60 games, another 102 to go. And, Lindor is getting the boost. And because he's the highest paid player and he was the star, and he can't be batting .214. He's definitely going to come out of it. The question is when. And I think as Alonso and Lindor go, they'll go the Mets. And that's the way I see it. The pitching is going to come around. You know, once Quintana comes back, once you have that consistent five-man rotation, which we haven't had this year, I think everything's going to even out and it's going to start taking off. I expect a big second half. At least I'm hoping for a big second half.
So here's where I'll start with the specifics, Greg. You know, a lot of people from the beginning of the year have been calling for the kids. And we've gotten the kids at some points, and to a varying degree, they've been perfectly implemented into this situation. However, I think it's fair to say that the reason the Mets are struggling are not because of the kids. And there's probably some even more tinkering that you can do. Bring another kid up. Mauricio, of course, is who I'm referring to. To continue to light this fire that I believe this team needs. And if you look at all the different times that the kids have come up at this particular season, in this particular season, they have all of a sudden added a spark, which, of course, kind of goes out because there's just a little too much stagnancy with the roster itself. I think, you know, we're going to start getting into deep cuts here. I think that we have questions about the job that Buck is currently doing. And I think specifically when you look at the bullpen, it's almost as if he's experimenting to try to give people chances to take the bull by the horn. And they're not necessarily doing it. Leon, for example, on Sunday. So many different places we can go. And I kind of just put a couple things out there. But I guess let's start with the kids. And the way I see it, Greg, one way or another, I want to live and die by the children, by the farm system. I want this turnover to start, and I think you could see some of that is why they are 30-30. But again, I don't think it's just because they're relying on three rookies to be a major part of this team coming off of 101 wins, with most of the roster back, more or less. So I think that one way or another, And you could say what you want about the roster decisions with how these kids are implemented. I think you have to live and die by the kids, and I want one more up. What do you think?
I think to a certain extent they are getting there. Almost said to a certain extent they are there. They're not quite there when it comes to trusting the kids, none of whom started the season with New York. But after a while, yeah, three quarters of the potential baby Mets city kids, whatever you want to call them, are here. One of them, two of them are, you know, quite clearly here to stay. You know, one of them, Brett Beatty is the starting third baseman, even though now he's giving a start here and there to Eduardo Escobar. And listen, neither one of them owns that position. You can certainly understand one is slumping and one is hot. You go with the hot hand. That's fine. Everybody's here to contribute. We see it at the catching position where we all got very excited, and rightly so, about Francisco Alvarez as he suddenly couldn't come up without hitting a three-run homer, it seemed. Might have cooled off a little on the offensive side, is doing a very good job defensively, as is Beatty, who was coming along. That was my main concern with him. And the fact that today they designated for assignment, you know, career organization Met, Tomas Nito, seven seasons as something of a good soldier. Because suddenly, you know what?
Can I just break in and say
okay,
that is what I really wanted them to do. One way or another, I think that Escobar has a giant role in this team, which includes the clubhouse, and I think, to an considering how long he had been here, you could say that on the clubhouse extent to Nito. I think outside of that, Escobar provides a lot more than with potential, and Nito has arguably looked the worst he's ever looked at the plate during this entire tenure of 7 years of on and off time with this team. So good on them for making the correct decision. This is the first time hearing about it, and this is exactly what the catching tandem should be for the remainder of the season.
Yeah, Narvaez was eligible to come off the IL, and a decision had to be made. Nito was recently on the IL. We know he had the problems with the dry eye, and they did some things to help him along. Hadn't gotten much playing time since coming back. And, yeah, I mean, Tomas Nito, just to have a sidebar here, you know, has had an honorable career, let's call it, as a Met. Has never really been intended as the main catcher on this team. Sort of fell into that role once James McCann kind of crumbled last year. But they, you know, went out and got Narvaez with an eye on Alvarez coming along, and it all probably sped up a little more than they had planned, to the point where, well, we're not going to carry three catchers. You could, you know, always make a case for three catchers in my mind. But Nito, ergo, designated for assignment. Reportedly, they're going to work on a trade somewhere. And, you know, he'll probably wind up backing up Travis d'Arnaud in Atlanta and get a big hit against us. But, you know, we've had that baked in to our psyche. But, you know, okay, so we've got Alvarez. We've got Alvarez starting most days. We'll see what happens with Narvaez. We've got Beatty starting most days, and Escobar, a valuable veteran, who's hitting a lot better since he stopped being the everyday guy. And we've got Mark Vientos, who doesn't quite have a role and who hasn't quite been trusted, and either, you know, hasn't found his stroke yet on a consistent basis or hasn't had the chance to find his stroke yet. And he's probably the guy they have to figure out what they're going to do with, because he's not going to play third base if Beatty is that guy. And I don't know that they want him to DH on the days that Vogelbach isn't DHing. And as far as Mauricio yesterday, Sunday, Mauricio had a collision at second base. I haven't followed up to know how serious that was. Hopefully it wasn't any big deal. But the way he's been hitting, it's just a matter of time and finding him the spots where he can play, because, you know, he is a shortstop. He's not going to play shortstop because, like you said, Lindor is the highest paid player on the team, and he certainly isn't here to sit no matter how much he's been slumping. And Mauricio's been playing around the diamond and even in the outfield. So, you know, that's, I think, the infusion of youth that this team is having. I think it's a positive sign. And listen, I tend to be one of those, I don't know if I trust these kids types of fans, but they all earn their way up here. And I think, as importantly, this team felt stagnant. You know, the team that did not get off to the great start, mostly the same team as last year. And it's good to feel something changing. And the players who we've been reading about for 2 or 3 years apiece now coming into, if not their own, then at least getting invited in to prove themselves. And as far as the bullpen is concerned, since you brought that up, yeah, I think Buck Showalter is still a little bit in that 60 games in, that phase of not so much mixing and matching, but trying to get guys to step up, to use that cliche, because you can't every single day say, okay, we got Rowley and or Smith, then we got Ottavino and or Robertson, and then we will put them in some order. You have to be able to rely on everybody you have here. Otherwise, there's no reason for them to be here. So, which means that some days Steven Nogosic is going to be, wow, isn't he valuable? Some days it's going to be, oh my God, why are they running him out there? Same thing with Dominic Leone. Jeff Brigham seems to have moved up the food chain a bit, but again, you're not basing your season, no offense to those guys, you're not basing your season on Steven Nogosic and Jeff Brigham and Dominic Leone. You're basing your season, like you said, on Alonso and Lindor and McNeil and Nimmo and Marte. And none of them, on the whole, has been the kind of player in which you can just sit back for weeks at a time and say, wow, he's up, it's going to be great. They've all had stretches. They've all had moments. They've all had production that I think overshadows their numbers. We've seen Lindor drive in runs with the few hits he gets, but he's not getting enough hits. We've seen Alonso hitting a lot of home runs, but not doing a lot else when he's not hitting home runs, and you could go down the list. And again, without going through the whole roster, you mentioned, having that five-man rotation, Jeff. 2 40-year-old guys, essentially, at the head of your rotation, as great as they are, as great as they can be, and as great as they've been, you just don't know. And saying that this far into the season, first shot at going on what we consider regular rest, that in Japan is short rest. And we saw it didn't go so well when they tried it. So we're going to have to figure out what that's all about. So, we've just got a lot more question marks than I think we wanted to admit were out there back in March. And, June is not a great time to answer questions, but you'd rather answer questions in June than have to wait till September and ask the one question, which was, what went wrong anyway?
And this is, everybody is close enough. I haven't even, bothered to look at what the Mets' current wild card standings are, but they're, of course, close enough. And 5.5 out going into a 3-game set is not that bad. And the Mets, with everything that they just went through, have a chance to step up. And we've seen them step up against a lot of different teams this year, but sometimes against the Cubs and the Rockies, not to disparage those two ball clubs, but something just isn't sitting. And that's one thing against Toronto, and those were hard-fought games between both teams. But there clearly was a difference, and Toronto showed why they are in arguably the best division in baseball. Before I segue it to Jeff, I will throw it out there that I think Brigham, as well as Nogosic, have been stepping up much more than some of the other names thrown out there in terms of the mediocrity of this bullpen, which was, of course, made even more mediocre by Edwin Diaz. So I will start here, Jeff, segueing to you with similar questions about the kids as well as the bullpen and yada, yada, yada. Mark Vientos, any time that I see him in the limited amount of time that he's been able to get in there, even though he might not completely have his stroke, he does seem to do something productive, even if it doesn't necessarily have to, you know, bring in a run. Somehow, some way, he makes contact and gets the job done on a very small ball level if he's not swinging the bat. That's what I've noticed so far in the limited time that I've seen him on this team. So I think while they are trying to figure something out with Mark Vientos, I think there's a lot to be, you know, happy about when dissecting the performance so far.
Yeah, Mark Vientos, I am. He has limited playing time, obviously, and that he's not going to be able to get the consistency. But when he does get those hits, he's hitting the ball hard. He's making solid contact, be it, you know, a base hit or a sacrifice fly. He's making a solid contact, which is good to see. And you know, those balls will eventually drop in. I'd like to see him play, you know, consistently every day between righty and lefty. I mean, I really don't care about righty lefty so much, but you know, I know Buck loves Daniel Vogelbach, or maybe he doesn't. Maybe he's trying to get Daniel Vogelbach's value up because he is just, I know he gets on base. I know that's the big thing. But he's just clogged it up. He's looked at so many pitches. He's not swinging.
I think Vogelbach should be better than he ends up being. That's just my personal opinion. He should be better than he continues to show.
He's not what we thought we were getting when we traded last year. We traded Colin Holderman for him, and we thought he'd get, you know, at least a power bat, someone who can protect Alonzo in the lineup. And he's just not that. He's just a guy who, you know, to get on base, and when he gets on base, he can't do anything. He clogs up bases. So I'd like to see Mark Vientos take a shot at everyday DH. And actually, I think he's a little too young to be a DH, but that's the only position he can play right now. He really needs to get in there every day and just sit Vogelbach for a while and see what he can do. I mean, with him and Alvarez and Beatty in the lineup, let's see what these kids can do. They might bring the energy that they need. That's the way I see it. And you know, I just don't see Ronald Mauricio coming up anytime soon, although it'll be great. But where is he going to play? I mean, he needs someone who can pitch six innings and less than three runs, because that's the big problem here. We can't be relying on the Jeff Brigham and Dominic Leone of the world. I mean, I know Steven Nagosev has stepped up in a game recently, but that's only in mop-up duty. That's when he needs to save the pen.
A game 6-4 where he throws whatever the amount was, you know, that's a two-run game. You know, the offense should be able to step up and back up Nagosev at that point. You know what I mean?
Yeah, he came in at, 4-0 at that point. So, you know, we know that Senga didn't have it. And by the way...
Exactly. Thank you. So I was incorrect even, and I think the fact that he came in at 4-0 and they were able to do what they did, and then obviously Leone did what he did, but, like, you know, that's, I think, my point is that Nagosek, it's mop-up duty, but it's like at 4-0, it is proper mop, or, you know, it might have even been 4-1 at that point.
Right.
Maybe it's the mustache. Maybe I'm just defending his stash. Like, you want a guy with that kind of stash on your team who's performing well.
Let me just say this about Cody Senga. I think he's going to have to get used to going every 5 days. I know this is his first time through, and even the first time through, he's going to have an adjustment, but he's going to have to step up and get used to pitching every 5 days, because you don't do that in Major League. You don't pitch every once a week. You're going to have to pitch every 5 days, and he's going to have to step up and get used to it. And I'm sure, and I'm hoping he will be able to make that adjustment.
So, Greg, I'll go over to you with Senga. Do you think the Mets need to stop experimenting and just let him get used to one thing or another?
I guess they will have to work with him and figure that out for themselves. I don't know how much of his really disappointing outing on Sunday was a matter of not enough rest or it just wasn't a good matchup for him. You know, he does well with teams that chase, and I know the Braves are a team that chased. I thought they might hold him back, but he's also been, again, fantastic at Citi Field, and I could see wanting to take advantage of that, and also the fact that, what are you going to do, call up David Peterson again, who, you know, again, has had a string of really good starts at Syracuse, but we kind of, you know, ridden the David Peterson merry-go-round this year, and it's been more Rumble Pony than major leaguers, shall we say. So, yeah, I tend to agree that it's time to say, you know, hey, Kodai, this is how we do it. This is Major League Baseball in North America, and I'm sure it's not a surprise. I'm sure when he signed, he understood how pitching rotations work here. And, you know, it'd be great if you could get him extra rest. It'd be great if you could get Scherzer and Verlander extra rest when you're and Carrasco when you're talking about guys who probably could use it as they go along. You know, fortunately, they've had in their own ways plenty of rest this year because none of them has pitched every time out, and hopefully that will work to their benefit as we get deeper into the season. So, you know, you'd love to just keep relying on the five guys you have with the understanding that McGill is kind of a stopgap, but at this point he's also, you know, part of the package. And then, yeah, the fact that Quintana is making progress toward coming back is very encouraging. Again, I don't think we saw our season coming down to when will Jose Quintana come back. There's always, though, that sense of, you know, we've all used the cliche. It'll be like trading for a pitcher at the All-Star break or whenever he comes back. The thing about the playoff picture that you mentioned, I mean, again, that is the great forgiving element of a 500 team in this league at this time. Because unlike other 500 teams in the Met past, it's not a matter of, oh, God, you know, we're 5.5 behind Atlanta, as you said, what are we going to do? You know, the wild card came into existence, and then two wild cards came into existence, and now three wild cards are in existence. And if you do look at the standings, you'll see the Mets aren't in the playoff picture today. Again, in 2020, that would have mattered. It was a 60-game season. Of course, you had eight teams going to the playoffs that year, and somehow the Mets missed it. But more importantly, the Mets are, what, I think a game and a half maybe at most, behind whoever's got the last wild card now. And we're talking about
Miami.
Wow, so there you go. And then the whole National League, although there's beginning to be a little bit of separation, so the whole National League is still in it in a way. Somebody gets ridiculously hot. I mean, there are going to be a few teams. You're not going to see Colorado. We're not going to see Washington. We're not going to see Cincinnati, but and who the hell knows with St. Louis. But, you know, it's still up for grabs. And, you know, right now this season feels dependent on the fact that all it's going to take is two very good weeks and you're in pretty good position, and then you hope you don't slide back.
You are listening to the Metsian podcast, and since we're almost to the half-hour mark, I'd like to pass it around for our shameless plug and Metsian stories, because there might be some listeners out there that have never either listened to the Metsian podcast or heard these fellas on the Metsian podcast. So I'm first going to go to our featured guest for the evening, Greg Trintz of Faith and Fear in Flushing and National League Town. But Greg, you know, in however you can sum it up, what is both your shameless plug and Metsian story?
My shameless plug, and you were nice enough to give them. Faith and Fear in Flushing, the blog for Mets fans who like to read. I've been writing it with Jason Fry since, as you said, 2005. National League Town, a podcast I've been doing since 2022 with my friend Jeff Heisen. Mets fandom, Mets life, Mets history, whatever the order is on our logo. And my Metsian story is now 55 seasons as a Mets fan, living and dying with this team, always living. And I suppose, you know, even the dying the next day, we're back at it. So, you know, this is a good time overall to be a Mets fan. We're complaining about a 500 season, which means we expected more, which means we are living in an era, I think, that, you know, encompasses expectations, and we've lived in enough of them where we've had no expectations, and we're you know, debating the breadcrumbs that are left behind. You know, we're getting a nice meal out of the Mets these days, especially since Steve Cohen bought the team, and we feel like something is going to happen. And we might wind up disappointed. It's been known to happen, but... you know, I can be as fatalistic and cynical as the next Mets fan, but ultimately, messianically speaking, I'm pretty upbeat about this team and pretty upbeat about being a Mets fan and happy to be here with you guys.
And we thank you, Greg, for being here. Jeff, you know, I said earlier that his blog, Greg's blog, Faith and Fear in Flushing, was 18 years old and could smoke now. But he also said, hey, no smoking. We're only voting. So my Mets fandom is now from 2005, 18 years old, and can do all of the above. So as I pass it over to you for your shameless plug and Metsian story, I just had to throw that out there.
Oh, thank you, Sam. Yeah, I've been a Mets fan all my life. I was born in 62. I always say I was born the same year as the Mets. So, you know, I've been a Mets fan my whole life. Actually, I used to live in Flushing, and I used to walk over to take the bus to the Main Street and walk over to Shea Stadium. It was a great time. So I've been a Mets fan living and dying my whole life with the New York Mets. And, you know, it's a lot of heartbreak, but there's, you know, the good times are great when they happen. So, yeah, definitely a true, I bleed orange and blue. And I'd like to also say thank you for having me on. You know how much I enjoy your podcast. I enjoy Greg's podcast as well with Jeff Heisen. I mean, that's on my rotation every week as well. So definitely we have some great Mets fans doing podcasts. My shameless plug is based on Beneath
You,
where we're not necessarily a Mets podcast per se, but we do have our share of Mets, and for some reason we're partial to Mets catchers. I mean, we had on Ed Hearn and Todd Pratt and Josh Tolley, Barry Lyons, Mackie Stassis, Duffy Dyer, and coming up in the next week or so is going to be 1986 Mets, although he didn't catch all that much, but he was a manager of the Toronto Blue Jays. John Gibbons is going to be joining us in a week or so, so that's something coming up. We've also had a lot of faithful authors. We've had, if you remember, Jeremy Astell of the San Francisco Giants, three-time World Series winner. And he has a fantastic story that if you have a chance to check out, please do, because he was a fantastic guest. And we have also our share from the world of barbecue. So please check out Baseball and BBQ and all your podcast apps.
Excellent. And, you know, it is interesting the way you describe all the different Mets catchers that you've had on here. That is a plethora. And I remember when I came across Mackie Sasser's, I want to say, Topps card, 1987 or so. I think it was probably the 87 one. When I came across that, I said, that is quite possibly the greatest baseball name I have ever seen, and I would love to tell him that, and I will try to do that, you know, at some point. But that's amazing, and everybody go listen to Baseball and Barbecue. It is just such a fantastic. I'll segue over here real quick. How about on a barbecue perspective? Like what are some of the great guest, even though, you know, I'm not, I haven't delved deep, you know, I haven't done the deep cut into barbecue the way you guys do, But if you could explore that real quick.
Sure. Well, you know, there's actually a barbecue Hall of Fame. And so we've had on some of the people who have been inducted into a man named Sterling Ball, who I really never heard of before, but my partner, Len Aberman, has. He has to be very big in the world of music as well. So he was very interesting. If you like smoking ribs, there's a website called AmazingRibs.com, and the guy who runs that is called Meathead, and that's what could be confused with Meathead of All in the Family, but actually his nickname is Meathead, and he has a great website as well if you'd like to check that out. Or we've had on a man named Ben Arnault, who's from Australia. So he was interesting, having barbecue down under. Heath Wilds is another person who's in the Barbecue Hall of Fame who should be checked out. So we get our pitmasters, authors, barbecue authors, inventors. So anybody that has to do with the barbecue, they like to come on it, and we talk to them about it.
That's amazing. That's fantastic. So I guess I will pass this over to Greg this way. The 2023 Mets, who do you want to grill right now?
In the barbecue sense?
Yeah, the barbecue sense, not in terms of who do you think could be the tastiest. Let's not go there because that's a show. But, you know, from a grilling perspective, who are you that most fed up with? Who do you think you, like,
okay.
if you just go down that type of rabbit hole of grilling someone for making this a 30-30-60 game stretch, who would you go at first?
Well, I'm not much of a griller, but I do appreciate what Jeff and Leonard do with baseball and barbecue. It's such a distinct and passionate show, and I congratulate them on continuing to bring on net catchers and so many fun guests. Listen, I'm not the biggest Daniel Vogelback fan in the world. Let's put it that way. Although I try to be patient, you know, he's here to do one thing in his job title, hitter. Yeah, and then, you know, there's a place for that in this game. But you know, the fact that not enough hitting from the designated hitter, and maybe I'm just allergic to somebody whose job it is, or whose job description is something I still can't quite accept, is in the National League, and a fact of Met life every day, and the fact that, you know, he gets on seventh, eighth inning, one-run game. Well, you got a pinch run for him, and so you're now using up another roster spot. It seems sometimes, especially when those guys, the Tim LoCastros. And before him, the Terrence Gores and the Travis Jankowskis, although Jankowski did not overlap with Vogelback, so let me not rewrite history. Just that there's something, you know, so one-dimensional, and that one-dimensional isn't cooking, to use at least a word related to grilling, it can be kind of frustrating. But listen, I'm sure he's frustrated. I'm sure they're all frustrated. I don't really want to grill these guys. I want to be empathetic toward the Mets, understand that they can't be on point, to use Keith Hernandez's favorite phrase, every single day, that they are human, that they are going to come out of slumps, that slumps happen. But then, you know, I'm a fan, and I look at 30 and 30, and although I've lived through a lot worse than 30 and 30 after 60 games, we kind of see 30 and 30 is not getting it done just yet. But again, as Jeff and Baseball and Barbecue could tell you, you know, sometimes it takes a while for a wonderful piece of meat to be done. So let us hope that this is a slow grill and that the juices are flowing and that I'm using all these phrases correctly, because I don't really do much of that. But let's get something tasty going. The next 102 games, what do you say?
Well, you know what? That was Greg, a great writer.
Exactly. No, exactly. And I try to keep up, my God. And so I will go over here, Jeff, with all that said. You mentioned Vogelbach earlier. Isn't the point of the DH role to be hitting home runs? If he's going to be behind, and I've been saying this from the beginning, like even with his second half that he had last year, I've been saying, please stop hitting Vogelbach behind Alonso. I think Buck at some point, you know, has pulled back a little bit on that, but it's still like an idea, because I think the idea and what Buck's idea is, this guy can get into one. If you're trying to protect Alonso, who's one of your better hitters, and we'll get to this, we'll get to Alonso, because I think that's a proper separate subject, the year he's having. Vogelbach is supposed to get into one occasionally. And you watch him just look at these pitches because he wants to get on base. And I'm starting to come around to the idea. Rich Spirago, who's one of our podcast padres, he talked about how the on-base percentage he provides is immediately shrunken because he's not getting enough hits and he's not valuable on the bases. Now, I will argue that Vogelbach has a bit of a quicker quicker leg than you would expect from him when he gets going, but he has to get going. He's not about to try. You know, they literally made a commercial about how it's silly of him to try to steal a base. But I will still back up that I think he has a better stretch than some. So when you're talking about Vogelbach, like, I'm starting to understand how that on-base percentage, as Rich Spirago pointed out, kind of is limited one way or another. If he's not, and that's where I'm seeing him just taking these pitches that he can crush down the pipe. You mentioned this earlier. I've ranted enough. Go ahead, Jeff.
Yeah, I mean, when Mets traded for Vogelbach, you thought he was going to be that, you know, that thumper behind Alonso, and he just never got going. And you're right, he's taking pitches like right down the middle. We watch it on TV. We go, how can you not swing at that? And I think he might be guessing too much, but you did make a good point where he is probably a little faster than he lets on, but he has to get going. And when he gets walked, he's not really going to get going. You know, he's not going to go first to third. He might go from second to home because he can get those legs moving. But first to third is not happening. And he just clogs up the bases, and he's just not hitting where we thought he'd be hitting. And it's just, I think it's time for him to cut bait with Vogelbach. And although he seems like a nice enough guy, I mean, same thing with Tomas Nito. He was a good enough guy on the clubhouse, but he's just not bringing any value to the DH role. And DH role used to be, you know, oh, that's the thumper, that's the home run guy. Not anymore. That position has changed. If someone's getting a day off or a half day off, let's give Nimmo the run around the outfield. Let's give him a DH spot. Let's give someone else, Marte, a DH spot. That position has changed. It's not just for a thumper anymore. And Daniel Vogelbach, I think his time is going to be limited. I think he's going to be he might be done by the All-Star break.
Hey, if he keeps going the way he is, I think you're right. Greg, I will go to this next segment before Pete Alonso, actually. I'm curious about your opinion, and as well as Jeff, on Max Scherzer and Justin Verlander. You guys talked about the top of the rotation, 40-year-old pitchers. So since this is the first time we're having you on, your overall assessment of the job both are doing, by all means, I would say start with the one who has been here the longest, Max.
Max took a little while to find himself in this new era of the pitch clock. I don't think we can underestimate how much this has probably affected everybody. Granted, it affects everybody on every team, so it's not just the Mets, whether they're the batters or the pitchers, and the clock is ticking, who are going to have to adjust. But, you know, we're concerned about the Mets. And Scherzer, who has appeared, you know, mostly from a distance all those years with Washington, but with us last year, you know, whether you want to call him a creature of habit, which is what all starting pitchers are, or somebody who is just, you know, very focused, meticulous, whatever you want to call it, you're throwing this wrench into his way of doing things that has gotten him very far. And it appeared that, I won't say upset him, but he's having a bit of a hard time coming to grips with it. I shouldn't use grips because he got suspended for perhaps using something to grip the ball, whether it was sweat and rosin or whatever they thought it was. That's, you know, again, little by little, it seems like those adjustments are behind him, as they are, I think, for a lot of pitchers. And certainly Scherzer is equipped to make adjustments. He, you know, I don't think Max Scherzer needs me to critique his pitching or his approach. You know, my, I wouldn't even call it an issue. Who the hell am I to have an issue with Max Scherzer? But, you know, I guess coming into this season, I was still kind of getting used to Max Scherzer being Max Scherzer of the New York Mets because it still seemed kind of foreign to me. This is just me as a fan talking. I mean, we just came through the embers of the era where we were living the dream of, you know, the homegrown star rotation. And all those guys are gone now, which is such a sad thing to say. I mean, you know, they're alive, and four of them are still pitching in some capacity. And, you know, the last one to leave certainly got a good deal for himself in Texas. But I just felt sort of at a loss not having Jacob deGrom being the one who I was waiting to come off the injured list for. And kind of thinking, what is Max Scherzer doing here, even though I've had 2 years to get used to it? But that's my problem. That's not his. I think overall, Scherzer in recent outings has looked better and better. And, you know, I kind of, you know, look around and think I don't want to put too much blame on any given Met. Like, he's not the reason they're only 500. He's not the reason they're only 500. Well, Scherzer's not the reason they're only 500. You know, to a certain degree, he may be a reason early in the season, but we're here now, and I think we're well-positioned. And as far as Verlander, it's a little bit of a small sample size because he only came back in early May. He's had some fantastic outings. That Sunday night against Cleveland was, to use one of the cliches of our age, a master class in pitching. It was fantastic to watch. And then he's just had some nights where, for whatever reason, it's not happening. But, again, you know, he's a guy I always loved to watch when I saw him with Detroit or Houston. And it's always different when they're in your uniform and you're seeing them every day or every start and you pick up on every imperfection. So I don't want to say the jury's still out again. Who am I to be, you know, calling in the jury on Justin Verlander? But, you know, are you better off with Justin Verlander and Max Scherzer than two replacement-level veterans? Yeah, I think you're much better off. And as long as it's not keeping this front office from making other moves in terms of salary because they're both getting a boatload, to put it mildly, and that doesn't seem to be an issue with this ownership, you know, let them find themselves. And like I said earlier, I hope the fact that they neither one of them pitched all that much to start the season means they will have more in the tank as the summer progresses and as we get toward September and hopefully a postseason.
I would agree. I'll pass it over to Jeff. Max and Justin so far.
Yeah, I'm in, again, total agreement. I think Max Scherzer, it took a while to, like Greg said, find himself. I mean, after the ups and downs, the stops and starts with the suspension and whatnot, I think finally he's realized how to pitch with the pitch clock. He's figuring it out. In the last couple of outings, he was really, really good. Same thing with Justin Verlander, albeit they take out the this Colorado factor. He's been very good also. I mean, he only gave up one run to Toronto, I mean, on the second pitch of the game, but that was it. He gutted it out. He knows how to pitch, and he's been doing better last couple of outings, like I say, except for Colorado. So I think we're better off with Max and Justin at the top of the rotation. I just wish they impart some more of the knowledge, and a lot of knowledge that is, to a guy like Tyler McGill, who's only 27 years old, who can't seem to get past 5.5 innings, or he can't get past the 6th inning. He just hits that wall, and maybe they can impart some type of knowledge to get him over that. Because Tyler, I went to the game Saturday, by the way. I'm sure we'll get into the Hall of Fame ceremony shortly, but Tyler McGill pitched really well, except for walking everybody. He walked 5 walks and gave up 5 hits, but he able to gut it out, but he never got past the 6th inning. I would love to see him take that next step, and hopefully Max and or Justin could show him the rope how to do that, because that would really, really help the team.
I'm really happy that Tyler is gutting it out one way or another. I think he can. I think that this is the time and place to do so. And one way or another, you know, he's got to be better, you know, one way or another, because who knows exactly what this rotation is going to look like if and when Quintana can come back. So I think that that's something to think about one way or another. So I will move it over to Alonzo, and I'll start with you, Greg. I guess I'll say this, and I think you'll understand where I'm coming from. I never saw Alonzo as a Dave Kingman type. And I think that for the average, when you look at the numbers he's having, it's a very weird season to dissect.
Yeah, Pete Alonzo is a better all-around hitter than Dave Kingman was in all except Kingman's absolute best years, which was only a couple. And believe me, you know, I'm like any kid who grew up in the 70s as a Mets fan, in awe of Dave Kingman hitting home runs. Yeah, Pete Alonzo has this ability to be locked in for a week, and you don't want to pitch to him if you're the opposition. Conversely, you want him to be pitched to if you're us. This season, he seems to just not be feeling it consistently. And this is, we're talking about a guy leading the major leagues in home runs. And again, what I was saying before about when it's your own guy, you see all the imperfections. I'm sure the fans of 29 other teams would look at his statistics, at least, you know, that main statistic, and say, wow, you guys have Pete Alonzo, you're really lucky. And we are. You know, he's going to work at it. We know that about him. And we believe he has the ability to become the same kind of consistent player that, you know, we're talking about an inconsistent team. And, you know, this is an interesting time in Alonzo's career, because he's theoretically a free agent after next year. They've signed lots of players to long-term deals, bought out arbitration, that sort of thing. Alonzo is still out there. You know, he's a Met this year, and he's a Met next year, and it's hard to imagine him in any other team, any other uniform, but you know, the longer they go without deciding that Pete Alonzo is our future, guy who has done it in New York, and all he needs is to stay and be in good health to own every power hitting record the Mets could possibly have. Do you make that commitment? And do you not make that commitment because of what you're seeing this year, where even anecdotally, somebody is saying, well, you know, I don't want to say he's like Dave Kingman, but, you know, you wouldn't mind just having the guy who hits, you know, is on pace for 60 home runs after a third of a season, even if there's a bad week here or there. As I think you already said, Sam, as Alonso goes, so goes the team. And Alonso hasn't been going that great. Got just above the orange line in the umpire's viewpoint yesterday and got the Mets, I believe, to a tie at that point. But, he hasn't been hitting and they haven't been winning. So that puts a lot of truth in there. Now, Pete Alonso is going to play first base most days. If you felt you had enough confidence in the depth of the team, you would give him a blow and let him be the DH, let him be the slugger that we believe the DH is supposed to be, and then get him out there playing first base the rest of the week. So, you want more because we're greedy and because he set us up to be greedy. We're all, we're all essentially calling out for the pancake triple play, except we want it with four bases and we want it practically every day. So, I don't really worry about Alonso, just as I don't really worry about Lindor. But, you get a little impatient because that's what we do and that's who we are.
Good point, and that hasn't even been a full topic. But I guess it's because I arguably, maybe Pete Alonso is more of a, like you said about the contract status. And Lindor, I also think, he's not getting it done on the offensive side, but he never doesn't get it done on the defensive side. And it's quite astonishing to see, really. And we don't discuss it enough because we don't think about defense enough and the idea that somebody isn't getting paid for just defense, and he's not. For sure. But I love Lindor. And I love Alonso. And I'll pass it over to Jeff for the Alonso part. I just think he should generally be between 270 and 280. And I think this is the deepest into the season where you see these types of numbers of Alonso. Any year that I can remember him being in the league. So, after you.
Yeah, I think he's gonna get to back to his baseball card or the front of the baseball reference page. I mean, he's a career 258 hitter, and yes, we'd like to see his average going, I like 275, 280, and he's gonna hit his home runs. Very, very streaky hitter, we know that, but he can carry a team on the back. But I like to focus on his defense because he was got into the league and he was given a very bad reputation of being a terrible fielder. And I haven't seen it this year. I've seen him make plays that, oh my God, you didn't think that was Pete Alonso over there. You'd think he was, Paul Goldschmidt or something. And he's been really spectacular. Maybe not spectacular is the right word, but he's really been improved much on his defense. And people really have not seen that or talked about that. He's really become more of a complete player, albeit his average is kind of low. I'm sure that will grow as the season goes on. I think he will he'll hit between 40 and 50 home runs. He does that on a normal basis, and he'll get his knock. It's just it'll come in bunches. He'll carry team for a week or two, and then he'll go into a slump. But his fielding has just been, like I said, very, really good this year. What do you guys think?
I agree. He's a solid first baseman, and maybe it's because there was so much emphasis on his power hitting coming up through the minors that it just became shorthand to say, well, we have to live with his defense. A little like Alvarez. We were led to believe that, Alvarez is really going to have to work on the catching because he's such a good hitter, and maybe he should be a DH. You have a problem with Alvarez as a catcher? Because I sure don't. And
no,
I think he's going to only get better. And Lindor.
I think you. Lindor
is, sparkling defense and hasn't let down where that's concerned. So I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that in terms of Alvarez, I think there are some growing pains here and there, but you expect it. I think the growing pains are literally rookie mistakes. How old is he? 20 years old, right?
Yeah. 22. He'll be 22 in 2023. I forget when his birthday is. He's 21 now, I think. Yeah.
Okay.
In November. Yeah, so he'll be 21 the whole year.
So,
yeah, he's born 2001,
yeah.
Guys.
You know,
think
so
about
like,
that.
That's what you see. That's what you see. Yeah, exactly. You know, he's just able to drink in New York City. That's something to think about when he's behind the plate is the fact that, like, the mistakes that he's made are very, all right, well, he's a 21-year-old rookie. You know, he has adjusted himself extremely well. And I know you sent it over, Jeff, with Alonso, but I'll send it back over one more time with the defense of Alvarez.
Yeah, very, very good. I mean, the pitch is really like thrown to him. He's a good the pitch framer, I guess that's the term these days. But he's stealing strikes. I mean, he really has a gun for an arm. Well, he made an error the other day, which, you know, run a score, but that's more unfair than anybody else. But he really has impressed behind the plate, and pitchers really love throwing to him. So that's one of the reasons why they were comfortable letting Neto go, because Alvarez is going to be the guy. They know he's the future, and he's going to have some growing pains, but that's okay. It happens to everybody. And at the 21, and look, they're catchers in the minor leagues or older, you know, 24, 25. I mean, even the Mets draft pick last year is older than Alvarez. I mean, Kevin Parada is older than Alvarez. So, you know, Alvarez is going to be a really, really good catcher for a long, long time, and the Mets are very, very fortunate to have him.
Yeah, we really are. You know, we're sitting here 30-30, but Francisco Alvarez, Greg, is our catcher, and we've been talking about that for a very, very long time. And before I pass it back over to you, since it's been over an hour, I just have to say you are listening to the Metsian podcast, and thank you for doing so. Greg, the catcher that we've been hoping for a long time, has finally come up.
Sure has, other than a few fleeting moments of Travis d'Arnaud, at his best, you know, his pre-Brave best, let's say. You know, we've shuffled through a lot of B-teamers, you know, so, some guys who had good moments. Wilson Ramos had a really productive second half his first year as a Met, and hey, James McCann, who didn't win many fans in New York, did catch a no-hitter, five different pitchers. So, you know, you've had a lot of guys crouching and putting the mitt out, and never without the sense that, boy, why didn't they go after JT Realmuto or somebody of that ilk? Or when are we going to have a guy like that? And I had to be reminded the offseason when Realmuto was a free agent that there was this kid Alvarez coming up through the system. And I said, okay, well, let's see what that's all about. And, you know, we all look at the Braves the last five or so years, one youngster after another coming up, being trusted to do a job and doing the job, and suddenly remaking the whole Braves NL East dynasty and winning a World Series one year. And we can't help but ask now and then, why can't we have some of that? And this is what we're getting now. And again, it probably isn't every day all their young players in Atlanta coming through. It just feels that way. But, and, you know, it's not going to be every day that all our young players are going to be coming through. But if they're coming through enough days, whether it's Alvarez, whether it's Beatty, whether it's Vientos, and hopefully Mauricio, wherever he winds up playing, you know, again, that pushes you forward, and maybe there's a little less, you know, signing 10-year contracts to shortstops from Cleveland. Not that I'm unhappy by any means to have Lindor here, But you like the idea of growing your own, not just for the romance of it, but just because it's more efficient. And it's a younger team by definition, because you're not going out into the market and saying, let's sign this 39-year-old pitcher and this 40-year-old pitcher. And you know, honestly, the one thing I'm missing right now, and I know there are a couple of names down below, I'm missing the idea that there's some great Met pitcher on the way, because that's sort of, you know, that's our lifeblood and has been through the history of this franchise when it's either been at its best or has been on the verge of being at its best. And that, you know, that's what got us to the heights we achieved within the last 10 years when we had those pitchers. And right now, you know, that's not what the pipeline has, at least not ready to pop. So I'm hoping over time we'll hear more about that and see more of that. But just from the catching position alone and just the fact that he has jibed with Scherzer and Verlander and all the rest, and you don't hear any whispers about, I don't want to throw to this kid. They all want to throw to this kid. They see what he can do, and he's, again, very lively back there, very proactive. And, again, this is his position. This is what he's been doing all his life. Sometimes I think we just forget about it because a player is young and maybe he's from somewhere else, so we don't think he's going to be up to the major league level and up to the major league job. But showing all signs of being that, you know, conversely, you don't want to just ink somebody's name in for the next 10 years and say, well, that's settled, because you never know. But from what we do know and what we can glean, it's a good time to be in the Francisco Alvarez business. Let's say that.
Yeah, you're getting it at, you know, Apple in 75, right? Or whatever year in the 70s that was. Yeah, you know, that's what it feels like, for sure. And like you say, knock on wood. But I'll pass it over to you with this, Jeff, that Lindor, I still can't help but feel like this is all growing pains for an eventual just unique moment for this era of Mets fandom. When it comes to Lindor, and I phrase it that way because I don't want to jinx anything, but if you're picking up what I'm throwing down, you know, I get where, and Greg was like, I'm happy that Lindor is here, and I think that that's the point, is that Lindor came in here in his, like, I think he was like 26 or so, when he signed the contract, you know, even though he had been that 20-year-old kid coming up, he was getting in on the ground floor, and he was basically this first experiment of the Steve Cohen era. And he's as crucial to these kids coming up, considering that he's going, you know, we're married to him. He is a giant part of this. I just have a feeling, and I don't want to say it out loud.
Well, I think Mets fans want to love Francisco Lindor. I think Francisco Lindor wants to be loved by Mets fans. That is eventually, I think, is going to happen. He's going through a tough time right now. But he's a major league superstar. He is one of the highest paid players in the game, playing in New York, a premium position, and he's going through a slump right now. He will get out of it. I am confident he will get out of it, and he will be, you know, the regular Francisco Lindor who we've known, who played in Cleveland, who is going to play well for the New York Mets. That first year was tough. We get it. Always an adjustment period. 2022 is a very good season. I got MVP votes. He's struggling right now. He'll come around. I'm very, very confident of that. His defense has not gone down, so he's a great defensive shortstop. But his bat will eventually hit. I mean, he's been just – this past week has just been so overexposed with the strikeouts and the media – He just looked terrible at the plate. But he'll come out of it. I'm confident of that. Let me just say one thing about Francisco Alvarez. We have Brody Van Wagenen to think about, to thank about for Francisco Alvarez, as he's the one, him and his team found him in Venezuela and signed him to that as an international free agent back then. So Brody Van Wagenen, maybe not the best next GM, but we have him to thank for Francisco Alvarez.
Well, at least we have that to thank, because, Greg, everybody was talking about J.D. Davis up until the point last year where that guy turned Darren Ruff, and look how that one turned out. But anyway, Lindor. Here, I will say this about Lindor. It always seemed like he, and I heard this about him, that he doesn't really get going into the second half in terms of hitting. And I think that's part of what's going on now. But at the same time, he evened out at 275 sometime after the All-Star break last year. He was hitting in the 240s consistently for a while at the beginning of last year. So at what point, though, do you not accept that as the case?
He's got a second half. He's got 100 games, and what are we on? Eight years or whatever of his contract remaining. He's going to be out there as long as he's healthy. And I don't really. I understand why somebody strikes out, and you have to express your frustration if you're sitting there, and it comes out as a boo. I don't really see the point of that if this is the guy who is your shortstop for most of the next decade. You might as well just understand that not every at-bat and not every week is going to be an explosion of offense. But, like you guys said, we want him to succeed. It's not good about getting used to Scherzer, getting used to Verlander. Getting used to Lindor maybe because it's been an extra year. I look at him now, and I kind of don't even remember that he came from anywhere. To me, he's been a Met for a while now, and he's, part of the same, the same family tree that brought us Bud Harrelson, Jose Reyes, even though I know he wasn't homegrown like those guys. And I hope when we're done looking back, we're talking about the greatest shortstop the Mets ever had, and believe me, there's few bigger Jose Reyes fans than I am, but I hope that Lindor supplants him on those sorts of all-time teams. And I think he's going to be fine. I mean, the fact that he's going through it now, he's not a 210 hitter, which means it's going to even out, that there is a second half, that there are 100 more games. So again, if the defense was wearing down, I might have my antenna raised. But I think, the fates or whatever they are going to owe him some base hits pretty soon, and he's got the talent and the drive and everything else to make that happen. So it doesn't look great now, just like it doesn't look great for the team as a whole, but it's going to look better. That's my sense.
I would agree, and so I will segue this chapter of the present Mets into the past Mets conversation. And you are listening to the Metsian podcast, and this is a big part of what we do. We not only celebrate the current history, and your cynics out there will say there's never anything to celebrate when it comes to the Mets, but of course, even in the moment, there's stuff to celebrate. We just did it with Alvarez, for starters. But in the past, I will segue to this, Greg, as I start with you. Forget about all the championship years, including the pennant-winning years. So when I say we're at 30-30, and I hope this, becomes a certain type of season, or this doesn't become this type of season. I don't yet have because again, I've canceled 2015 out of this. So I have a few years that I can pick from my own Mets fandom that I hope this doesn't become, as well as 1 year from the past of Mets fandom that I hope it doesn't become. So, but without the championship years, including the pennant-winning ones, what year do you hope, Greg, this becomes? And what year do you hope this doesn't become?
Well, if we're not including the championship years, why would I hope it doesn't become a championship year? But if you're just looking to avoid pretty obvious answers, 30 and 30, I tend to keep track of these things. I don't have it all in front of me, but I guess I was looking last night. A year that I think might serve as aspirational to a degree, 2008, the Mets kind of scuffled like this early in the season. And again, you were coming off a really miserable ending the year before, and they seemed to still be kind of hung over from that as that year went on. But about 86 games into the season, just before the All-Star break, they really got cooking. They won 10 in a row, going out of the first half and starting the second half, and Carlos Delgado was hitting like crazy, and Santana started locking in. And you know, there were holes and there were flaws and there would be injuries, and we know that 2008 did not wind up that great, but this team went from kind of scuffling around 500 to being a team that took first place into September and was in every position to make the playoffs. And if you had I'm always wary of applying current rules to past races because you just don't want to do that. But the team that went 89 and 73, which wasn't quite good enough to get into the playoffs that year, that would probably be plenty good to get in the playoffs this year. And this team is certainly as capable as that 2008 team. If we're, again, eliminating the championship years. And, you know, I guess I could have easily said 2016 because that was a wild card year. It was this kind of season, but 2008 was on my mind. The year I hope it doesn't become, another year where they were 30 and 30. 2002, a year that had lots of expectations. They made a lot of trades coming out of 2001, which was both an exhilarating year down the stretch, an emotional year, but also a hugely disappointing year most of that year. But they came out of 2001 having made a late lunge at a division title. It didn't work out, so they just sort of broke up what was left of the 2000 champions. But, you know, that was the year of Alomar and Vaughn and bringing back Burnitz and Cedeno and doing a lot to make a team that seemed it was going to, at the very least, challenge the Braves for the division title and be right there for the wild card, and they just scuffled and scuffled and scuffled, and they were 30 and 30, and they got only so far into that summer. I mean, I think they were four games over with about two-thirds of the season played, and then they just fell apart. They just were old and got old, and the reinforcements didn't reinforce anything. And it became, you know, one-third of a three-year disaster, a rolling disaster. It cost Bobby Valentine his job. It should have cost Steve Phillips his job, speaking of GMs with mixed track records. I don't think that this is what this team is. This team just has a better personality, a better collection of people, I think, and just feels more capable. But, you know, if we're going to look at teams that didn't seem to be going anywhere that put it together, yeah, you got to look at teams that didn't seem to be going anywhere and never really put it together. So, you know, those precedents exist. They probably exist further back as well, but I'll keep it fairly contemporary. So you want a team that stays in the race and makes noise and hopefully goes that extra mile. That precedent exists. You want a team that doesn't do those things? Let's not think about that. Yeah, that precedent does exist.
That's amazing. And I think that's exactly where I wanted to go with this conversation. So, Jeff, before I pass it to you, I will say mine. 2008, I think, is a perfect team to go with for me as well. So I appreciate you, Greg, for reminding me of that team. And as so far that, you know, you can never include 2006 because they were dominant the entire time. Like, that's part of their story. So we're looking at 30-30 teams. So when I'm thinking about that era, the 2008 team is probably my favorite amongst, you know, next to 2005, which of course was my first real Mets team. That ended up not being a 30-30 team. Let's point that out. But 2008 is a perfect example because they did turn it around in a very quick way in some fashion. And especially after, you know, Manuel took over with a very weird exit, and there was that whole Jose Reyes at the beginning of the whole thing where he temper tantrums off that he was getting taken out for a potential hamstring injury, I think, if I remember correctly.
Something like that.
After 2007, yeah. And after 2007, when I realized that I wasn't paying attention enough, that I was losing focus on what on baseball in many ways, where all of a sudden, as the Mets were falling apart, somebody pointed it out to me on the Philly side of things. 2008, I had said that I was going to make sure that I paid attention to every single moment of the season. I was very much back. And that was more of the heartbreaker at the end of the year than 2007 ended up being, because I was just there, you know, from a mental perspective, much more than I was in 2007. 2006, I was there intensely. So 2008, I think, is a perfect example of that, Greg. And you just made me remember it as my fandom turns 18. So in my fandom, I would say the 2 years that I hope this isn't, and the honorable mention of outside of my fandom will first off be 2012, where they were doing much better at this point, actually, crazy enough. They were a surprise team early on after 60 games. I will say 2009, where it was arguably still to this day my least favorite experience of Mets fandom, even though it was also the introduction to what is now a home we hold very dear. Even though we had many things to criticize about it at the time. Jeff, thanks for laughing. I'd say 2012 and 2009 are years that I hope this doesn't become. Even though 2012 is still, because of everything it is, one of my favorite Mets years in my fandom.
Yep.
I'm sorry. And 1978. I hope this isn't 1978.
Yeah, that was a pretty bad year, 1978. Well, I hope this team does not become... and it's just in terms of, because it's so much has been written and talked about the Mets' bloated payroll, I mean, I just hope this does not become 1992. You know, I don't see that happening. But just because the Mets spent so much money that year, the worst team money can buy and all that stuff, this is the most expensive team that's ever been put together. And we just hope that they don't explode and become something like that. I see this team right now. It kind of reminds me of 2016, where they just sputtering along the first half of the year and you know, make a run to make the playoffs. Remember, that was the year where I think the Grom went down at the end and Harvey went down and you had to bring up Lugo and Zimmerman. And it got them into the playoffs, although they lost that one-game playoff to the Giants. It just feels like this is the same type of year, just butting along the first half of the year. I hope they get out of this funk and they make a good charge at the end. And, you know, look, the playoffs are now, you know, I really don't care if they win the division or not. The Phillies proved last year you don't need to win the division. You just have to go be hot at that time. And hopefully the Mets can go on that run come September and October, which they couldn't do last year. They kind of petered out in mid-September, and then just it was a malaise for the rest of the year and into the playoffs. But hopefully they'll have enough energy and learn from their mistake last year and just keep going. Because I don't think they're going to win the division this year, but at least they can make the playoffs. That's what it's all about now. Baseball has been watered down
for
both seasons.
As we close in on 90 minutes, I think this is a good place to go with this team and coming out of an excellent Mets history discussion, just all around. Buck, I don't think I've honed in on Buck yet on this episode. So, Greg, what do you think of the job Buck is doing in his second season?
I think Buck has done a bad job of hitting and done an inconsistent job of pitching, and he hasn't made every play in the field, which is to say none of that is Buck's fault. I think he's mostly putting the guys out there who he believes and the infrastructure around has determined is most capable of succeeding. And he has had to massage personalities along the way, as every manager has to do, and has had to take the temperature of everybody's ups and downs, as a manager has to do, and make some in-game decisions, as every manager has to do. I've rarely come out of these games thinking, if only Buck Showalter had done this or that, we would have won that game we lost. I'm not sure I've come out of them thinking, boy, thanks to Buck Showalter, we didn't lose a game that I was sure we were going to lose. Maybe last year I felt that way more when maybe because of the novelty of having Buck Showalter as a Met manager and seeing all he was capable of was so bracing after, you know, so many placeholders in that job. For the most part, I am not unhappy. You know, you could question a bullpen move here or there. You could question maybe loyalty to a certain lineup configuration here or there. But I have faith that he's thinking about it 24/7, or, you know, every waking hour, and that he is giving it his all, looking for every edge. And you'd like to say that's what every manager does, but I don't think every manager does it as fully as Buck Showalter does. I still get that impression listening to him, watching him, to the extent that I'm capable of being not privy, but, you know, trying to be in tune with what the manager of the Mets is doing, whoever the manager of the Mets is. So, you know, I think they're 9 games. After 60 games, I think they're 9 games below where they were last year in terms of their record. And is that because Buck Showalter is a 9 games worse manager than he was last year? I don't really believe that. They've got to come through, the players he is trusting. Are there players sitting on the bench, sitting out in the bullpen, that, boy, why isn't Buck using them? Yeah, on a given night, I suppose you could say that, but I don't think that's it either. Again, We've devoted plenty of time to saying Lindor this and Alonso that. Yeah, you're going to sit Lindor and Alonso for more than a random day? No. It's, you know, same with Nimmo, same with Marte, same with McNeil. It's the players who have to live up to the baseball reference page. So I still have faith in this guy. I still think we're better off with him than we are with, you know, like I said about the pitchers. Would you rather have veteran manager replacement level, or would you rather have Buck Showalter? I'm very comfortable with Buck Showalter.
I think that's a good point. I do wonder, at what point does he become a Phil Jackson, who at a time that he wasn't a coach anymore and was now in charge of implementing an entire system on a specific team, showed that he was way behind the current game that was going on. And I do wonder, at what point does he become an Jeff, I hate to use this thing, this example, but I kind of have to, just even though it might have just been the element of circumstances. At what point does Buck Showalter become a potential Dusty Baker, who won his first world championship as a manager last year, to becoming a Bobby Valentine with Boston?
I think it's going to be more the former than the latter. At least I hope so. I think we all hope so.
Let me elaborate where it seems as if the game caught up to what they're trying to do as managers.
I don't think the game is passed Buck by. I think he's doing his job. He's doing the best job he can. I mean, I do a couple of questionable moves, especially this past week, and why he didn't walk Guerrero is beyond me. I have no idea. Was he afraid of Calvin, what's his name, Calvin Biggio, who has a 200 batting average? But he's doing the best job he can with the players he's given. I mean, even I get scared going to the bullpen. Who knows what's coming out of there? You never know from day to day. He doesn't have anybody he really can trust. Obviously, the Diaz injury is just was devastating to the team. Moves everybody up a notch where maybe they're not comfortable. I mean, he's only doing the best job he can, and I believe he still is the best manager for this team. A lot of experience, knows the game. Just with the game, he's the best manager for the Mets right now. I don't think there's anybody out there who would even be anything close to him. And I think he will get that monkey off his back eventually, if not this year, then next year.
Well, that is, I think, the hope that, you know, you got to believe. I'm not saying those names for. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that is what I want to happen. But I do ponder sometimes exactly who they, like you said, who would they replace them with. But I think that's another conversation for another day. And you have been listening to the Metsian Podcast, and we have arrived to our final word. First off, thank you all for listening to this podcast. We thank you for tuning in every week. Unfortunately, Rich Sparago could not be here, Michael Colon could not be here, and we wish them well, and let's go Mets out to them. And this is the segment that we like to call our final word. First off, let's thank our guests, and I'm going to pass it back once more to them, Greg Prince, Jeff Cohen. First to Greg for his final word and shameless plug again.
Thanks very much, Sam. Yes, shout out to Mike and Rich. Always love talking to those guys. And pleasure to be with you. Pleasure to be with Jeff tonight. Shameless plug. I write at faithandfearandflushing.com. I talk at National League Town. Please feel free to visit both. Last word, let's go with the first pitcher. in Mets history, Roger Craig, who just passed away at the age of 93, had been the oldest living Met until this weekend. Roger Craig, who brought to life the concept of you have to be pretty good to lose a lot of games, because Roger Craig lost a lot of games in 1962 and 1963, starting with opening night in St. Louis and continuing through, I believe it was an 18-game losing streak in 1963, which he was only rescued from with a Jim Hickman walk-off, I want to say grand slam, that summer. Just, you know, a guy who showed a great deal of good humor through the years. Reflecting on those days, certainly, I was going to say deserved more success, but he had success coming and going because he won championships in Brooklyn and Los Angeles before he was a Met, and he won a championship in St. Louis after he was a Met. So he was a very skilled pitcher, right-hander, and he would go on to have a great career as a pitching coach and a manager, ultimately winning a National League pennant in 1989 for the humbaby San Francisco Giants. The only complaint I have with Roger Craig is that he taught Mike Scott the split-finger fastball in the offseason prior to, it was prior to 85, and it came home to roost in 86. And we all know how Mike Scott paid the Mets back for trading him for Danny Heap in the 1986 postseason. Fortunately, it proved not to be fatal, so we can look back on Roger Craig. You know, when you grew up as Jeff and I did, you know, he was born in 62, I was born in 62, so, you know, we don't have a lot of memories of 62 as a Mets fan. But we learned about those teams inside and out because they were so much a focus of the between pitches chatter that Bob Murphy and Ralph Kiner and Lindsey Nelson gave us on Channel 9 or over the radio. And they talked about Roger Craig, and when Roger Craig would come to town with whichever team he was coaching or managing, he'd always take the time to talk to Ralph Kiner, whether it was Kiner's Corner or just an interview unbranded. And, you know, we learned about Casey Stengel, we learned about Marvelous Marvin, all those things from guys like Craig who carried the torch. And, you know, there are fewer of those guys carrying the torch for us any longer. Only 11 members of the 1962 Mets are still with us. And, you know, those are stories now left to the next generation, of which, you know, Jeff and I are privileged to be a part of and have certainly been carried forth by those who have succeeded those announcers. And I have a funny feeling Jeff might want to mention a little bit about a couple of those guys who he saw this weekend like I did. But just, you know, again, want to salute the first starting pitcher in Mets history, Roger Craig. Yeah. And if I can just throw in at least a battery mate, not his battery mate, but a battery mate in this realm, John Sullivan, catcher for the 1967 Mets, also passed away last week. And he was there when Tom Seaver was a rookie. Wasn't Tom Seaver's primary catcher, but he caught him a bunch of times, caught one of his first double-digit strikeout game in the majors, back up to Jerry Grody, as Jerry Grody was coming along. Neither one of them, quite frankly, was hitting very much. There was a little symmetry in the Tomas Nito being designated for assignment the same week that we learn about John Sullivan passing, because I get the feeling they were similar catchers. I'll just leave you with this that I learned about John Sullivan when I heard about his passing. Because like with Roger Craig, you know, guys go on and have careers in baseball if they're fortunate and they work at it long after their playing days. And in the same era that Roger Craig was going to the World Series as manager of the San Francisco Giants, John Sullivan was the bullpen coach for the Toronto Blue Jays, who won two world championships. And that is more than a footnote, because when Joe Carter hits that home run to win that World Series in walk-off fashion in Game 6, who gets the ball? Who picks it up? Who makes sure it gets back to Joe Carter? It's John Sullivan. So it may not mean a whole lot to us here in New York, and we may not have been too crazy to see Toronto this past weekend. But in Toronto, that makes you a legend. And, you know, you may remember that Tom House was the pitcher who caught Hank Aaron 7-15, probably the most famous "I got the ball in the bullpen." Well, I would say that John Sullivan, I don't know if he caught it on the fly, But he's certainly in that realm. I don't know if the ball wound up in Cooperstown eventually, but Sullivan liked to tell the story of how, you know, they came looking for it. And he said he kind of kept quiet because he wanted to make sure that Joe Carter had that ball in his possession. And what was it? They said on the Blue Jays broadcast, touch them all, Joe. You'll never hit a bigger home run. You know, John Sullivan was able to say to Joe Carter, hand him the ball, all 108 stitches, and say, touch them all, Joe. They're yours. So, these are the guys who come and go. I'm not going to pretend I've spent a lot of time in my life thinking about John Sullivan. I never saw him play, but I was aware of who he was. And Roger Craig is a cornerstone of the organization, but long before I started watching. But this is part of being a Mets fan, knowing your Mets, who got you here. So I'm sorry, they both had long lives, and hopefully they enjoyed their time in baseball and their time after and all of that. And I'm sorry they're gone. So to devote a moment or two in their memory, I appreciate the opportunity.
Roger Craig and John Sullivan, as I like to say, rest easy. I know the traditional thing is to say rest in peace, and I do hope everybody is resting in peace. That is for sure. But I think it, rest easy is also appropriate. So. This is the first time that I've been able to actually really that Roger Craig specifically I heard about yesterday, but I hadn't really been able to comment on it. And it's a 55 Dodger gone, and he was just coming up, I believe, at the time. And I believe he was a 55 Dodger, if I'm not mistaken.
He was.
So that also means he won in 59 for them. He was still on the team in 59. Right. So, and then he was 3 years later, you guys, he was a 62 Met and making the first pitching performance. And, one of these great pitchers, and especially, at the time, he's still coming up at the time, before I pass it to you, Jeff. He is there was more promise than you would even consider about that 62 squad. Looking back, when you look at a lot of the players on there, I think said, I forget exactly who did, that had you assembled this team 5 years earlier, we would have won a lot of ball games. But going to what Greg has in fact said about that 62 squad, that they lost 50 of the games, they had the tying run on base or on deck. Where they basically had a chance to win, get the out of the 120 losses. And at that point, if you even remotely try better for, just something different happens, 25 of those, then we're talking not a 120 loss and not even a 100. Lost team, So it's so interesting about talking about the 62 Mets and that Roger Craig and some promising players who still wanted to make an impact were on this team.
Yeah, they they win 25 of those games.
Did we lose Jeff?
But they still lose 95 games. They're just kind of boring.
Yeah, right. Definitely Roger Craig. Rest in peace. Rest easy. Also John Sullivan. But Greg, I never knew that John Sullivan, in Toronto, and the connection there. That's why you are the Mets historian. That's why he's. Greg is absolutely knows more than Mets than anybody else I've ever known. So, yeah, thank you. I just have one final word. I went to the Hall of Fame ceremony the other day at Citi Field, and just congratulations to Al Leiter, Howard Johnson, Gary Cohen, Howie Rose, and to Jay Horowitz. I mean, Al and Hojo, I mean, I loved Hojo. He was such a great man. Talking about 30-30, he's done 30-30 three times. A really great, underappreciated Met. Hojo is a really great guy. Al Leiter always gutted out, gave him everything. But Gary Cohen and Howie Rose, I'd like to say the soundtrack of the baseball season. They are just wonderful. We are so lucky to have those two as broadcasters, as we were when we were getting going up with Lindsay, Bob, and Ralph. We are very lucky to have really the best broadcast team in Major League. They win the World Series every single year, and very appreciative of them. And Steve Cohen for putting on such a great ceremony, and the speeches by all four of them were just terrific. And I just want to say thank you to everybody who attended. It was just a great ceremony. So that's my final word.
Absolutely, yeah, great day at Citi Field.
Yeah, go ahead, Greg.
Oh, I'm sorry. I just wanted to second that emotion. All four plus Jay with the Hall of Fame Achievement Award, all overdue. The whole Mets Hall of Fame backlog has made for some overdue inductions. The important thing is it's happening now under Steve Cohen. Just so proud and thrilled, especially for Gary and Howie. Again, that they carried on that tradition. They grew up like we did we say their names all the time, Lindsay and Ralph and Bob, and they have synthesized that and they have built on it. And, I envy the younger fans who even if they didn't have the thrill of the original three broadcasters like we did, if they're getting to know this team and this game from Howie Rose and Gary Cohn, they are learning it very well. And I appreciate that those guys continue to put forward the stories that they heard growing up from the original announcers, and they continue to add to it. And, they make our life away from the ballpark a pleasure, and it's almost like you've got to decide, do I really want to go to the game tonight, because I won't be able to watch it on TV with Gary Cohn, and I'm probably not going to be listening to it. Sometimes maybe with the earbuds in, but I'm not going to be listening to it with Howie Rose. So those guys, incredibly deserving, beautiful remarks on their part. Same for Al Leiter, who is at heart one of us, having grown up a Mets fan around the same time we did in the metropolitan area, and Howard Johnson, who became one of us once he was traded here from Detroit and found his niche. And yeah, first thing I thought of, Sam, when you said you want to do a show about being 30-30, I'm like, well, all weekend I was thinking 30-30 with Hojo. And, what a at first a surprise when he busts out as he does in 1987 from the shadows, and being, kind of an okay offensive player whose defense needs to be worked on, to an absolute force on the base paths and coming through, especially in the year where you began to see that both Keith Hernandez and Gary Carter weren't going to thrive forever. It was, such a bolstering of that lineup. And, he had three of the most remarkable seasons any Met has ever had, and had a career that's been worthy of recognition all these years. And again, I'm glad these things are happening. They put on quite a show when they induct guys, when they retire their numbers. And I'm just so glad that this is now part of the vocabulary, and we don't have to use the kinds of conditional terms we used to use when I would come on your show, Sam, and say things like, well, if only they would bring back the Hall of Fame, and if only they would retire this number or that number. And they seem to be doing it. And all we need to add to that now is why won't they add another banner up where the championships are? But we know they're working on that.
And first of all, I reiterate thanking you both for coming on this show. But to that point of thanking you, you know, this is what's the final word, and this is why we have both of you on here, to remind us and to remind me that this stuff recently, you know, just the details of everything that goes on with this team. And this is why you can get podcasts like this. This is why you can get conversations like this. And this is what I like about long-form Mets conversations that we have here on the Metsian podcast, is because it gives it time to breathe and gives it time to not only dissect what is going on with this 30-30 squad, but also dissect what a career the 30-30 member Howard Johnson had with this ball club, as well as what Howie Rose and Gary Cohen mean to every day that we live this squad. And if anybody can rival Greg Prince, even though I think one of them has cited him at some point, it is Gary Cohen and Howie Rose. And I believe, Greg, if I'm not mistaken, Howie mentioned you at some point, correct?
I'm going to betray modesty here and say that they both have. It's a great honor to be recognized by guys like those, and I do nothing but tip my cap in their direction. And it's just great to be all part of the same be part of the same ecosystem that we all are, in loving and remembering Mets baseball. And, again, our ears are in good hands with those guys.
And this is something that I think I will pass to both of you before we go. I think that regardless of everything we criticize, and I'll start with you, Jeff, regardless of everything we criticize the Wilpons for their time, they never misunderstood broadcasting when it came to the Mets. And when you look at who just got inducted, a lot of the decisions to keep these people involved did happen during the Wilpon.
That is very, very true. That's very true. They did have an appreciation of the broadcast business, I guess, by keeping these, and not just the voices of the Mets, but all the production people behind them as well. Let's give a shout out to them because they do a phenomenal job. And yes, the Wilpons need to be given credit for keeping the broadcast at least at the highest level, if not the ball club.
If not the
ball club. I would recommend, if you guys haven't seen it, if people listening haven't seen it, Tyler Kepner in the Times wrote an article touching on that, on the honesty of the Mets broadcasting and how Fred Wilpon, through all the travails of being Fred Wilpon and owning the Mets, said, "Hey, listen, don't be hurtful, but be honest." And he never tried to stop that, or at least to any great extent. And there was a time where Howie Rose, who to me, he's our Bob Costas as much as he is a successor to Bob Murphy, let's say, because he's just been more than just a play-by-play guy in the time that we've known him. And, you go back to Mets Extra on WHN when it became WFAN, and, he spoke for us without ever being first-person plural, which I think we appreciate that because we're from New York and we don't talk like that on the air. But, he was always the voice of the Mets and would always call out the Mets. When I say the voice of the Mets fan, let me be clear on that. He would call out the Mets when there was something ridiculous going on. And you know what? There were some prickly people in the front office who didn't care for that over the years. And if you would, next time you're in the Mets Museum at Citi Field, you look at this plaque, and I'd forgotten this. It has his years of service, as they do for all players and managers and so forth, and it says 1987 to 1993, comma, 1996 forward. And I was, that's right. They kind of took him away from Mets broadcasting for a couple of years there in the middle of the 90s because there was just this feeling that, well, Howie Rose is just criticizing us and we don't necessarily want him to be part of the broadcast. Well, cooler heads prevailed over time, and one of those was, in fact, Fred Wilpons. And I did see, I happened to have a media credential for Saturday because I wanted to be there to cover it as best I could. And I saw Fred Wilpon kind of slip into the back and sit there and support both Gary and Howie, and they each thanked him, as well as the players who, you know, were there under his ownership, and as well as Jay Horowitz, who, you know, Jay Horowitz worked in those years, which couldn't have been easy because the Wilpons did not inspire great publicity. But that is, you know, the genius of Jay Horowitz that didn't stop him by any means. So, you know what, though? You mentioned Brody Van Wagenen earlier, Jeff, and it just reminds me, it took me back to the summer of 2015 when there were these, what I consider to be these inane arguments on social media and wherever about, well, is this really Sandy Alderson's team or is it Omar Minaya's team? Because Omar signed this guy and that guy, but then here comes Sandy and he's just reaping the benefits. No, here comes Sandy, who'd made all these moves and he rescued us from Omar. Like, it's just never that simple. It's never that simple to say this is a good general manager, this is a good owner, this is a bad owner, it's a bad general manager. They all do good things, they all do not so good things, things that don't work out even with the best of intentions. So, you know, when you're building a team, you just hope as a fan that there is a positive legacy of some sort to be left behind by everybody, whether it was Brody Van Wagenen for a couple of years, whether it was Sandy Alderson during his long tenure or shorter tenure afterwards, whether it was the two guys whose name I can't even remember anymore who were here at Cone the first year that Cone owned the team. Everybody contributes, and I'm sure, you know, we don't use Fred Wilpon as a great object of affection after all we went through the last 15 or so years of his ownership, but no doubt he had his heart in the right place and did some positive things. And if that legacy is heard every night on SNY and on WCBS, then, you know, let's say, hey, thank you for that, Fred, and thank you for selling to Steve Cone. But, you know, we can't be totally gracious. But, you know, time marches on, and we're happy to be there.
I will finish with this as we close to the end of our show. Matteau. And I will say, as my final word, before we come up on the two-hour mark, Steve Cone, it's exactly where I wanted to go. There's still, as we sit here at 30:30, my final word is bigger picture. Steve Cone is still settling in. The 3 to 5 years, as Greg, I think, pointed out, is kind of trivial. It was kind of just something he probably improvised there. But I think it is a proper mark, and there have been expectations for the first 3 years here. So here we are. There's picture to look at, but we still have a series coming up against Atlanta where there's a lot to be said. Change the narrative. That's all I keep saying since last year. Change the narrative. And here we are. Hopefully we do. And let's go Mets. Thank you, Jeff. Thank you, Greg, Jeff Cone, Greg Prince, all you out there, thank you. Take care.
Thank you.